Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hart Glass, and it's time for It's All About Food. And thank you for joining me today. You are going to learn so much during this program. And once again, we will discover how it truly is all about food. And this time, it's about the Alzheimer's solution. And I can't wait to get started. I have the authors of this new book, The Alzheimer's Solution, which is coming out next week. And we have Dr. Ayesha Sherzai, MD, and Dean Sherzai, MD, PhD. Ayesha is the co-director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Program at Loma Linda University Health, where she leads the Lifestyle Prevention Program for the Prevention of Neurological Diseases. She completed a dual training in preventative medicine and neurology at Loma Linda University, received a master's degree in advanced research methodology from UC San Diego, and completed a fellowship in lifestyle and vascular brain diseases at Columbia University. And Dean Sherzai, MD, PhD, is also co-director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Program at Loma Linda University Health, where he previously was the director of memory and aging director, as well as director of research. During his years at Loma Linda, a blue zone community where residents live measurably longer and healthier lives, he was the lead scientist studying the effects of healthy living on cognitive aging. Dean trained in neurology at Georgetown University School of Medicine and completed fellowships in neurodegenerative disease and dementia at the National Institutes of Health and UC San Diego, where he studied under Dr. Leon Tai, one of the world's most renowned dementia researchers, and Dr. Dilip Jest, the world's foremost specialist in cognitive aging. He also holds a PhD in healthcare leadership with a focus on community health and a master's in public health from Loma Linda University, where his research focused on the prevention of cognitive decline through lifestyle changes. Welcome to It's All About Food, Ayesha and Dean.
Hi, Karen. Thank you so much for having us. It's a pleasure being here.
Hi, Karen.
The pleasure is mine. I've been carrying around your book all week. It's been a very unusual week for me because I have aging parents, and we spent a lot of time this week in clinics and the emergency room. It was an interesting time, and I carried this book around showing people the title because I wanted to engage in conversation and share everything that I learned. But let's jump in and talk about this very, very important book. The first thing I wanted to talk about was your brave choice to pursue lifestyle research. Can you share that story and the choices that you made to do that?
Yes. This came out of years of working in clinics, both in the hospital and the clinics, and realizing that what we have in the clinics and the hospital is not a health care, but disease care model. By the time patients come to us, the disease has fully manifested. And then if we want to reverse it, that's not the best place to do so. You can give some information, but usually patients weren't receptive. Healthcare takes place in the home, in the community. Healthcare takes place in conversations like what you're doing, probably more than any physician. This is why we decided that although there isn't a lot of research or funding in it, it is actually the most important thing we can do, given that both of us saw two of our brilliant grandparents dying from Alzheimer's. We knew that the approach had to be different. And then when we came to Loma Linda, we chose to come to Loma Linda from both NIH and UCSD was because this is the place where lifestyles not just studied but lived, and from validated data.
Absolutely.
Shown.
We had the privilege of working with different researchers and in different universities, like in Loma Linda University and Columbia University, and just essentially learning more about the impact of lifestyle on diseases. And we realized that, like Dean said, what we do is essentially care, and that we need to get out of this model and promote lifestyle.
You write early in the book that this lifestyle research is important, and yet there's very little coverage in the mainstream media, and the scientific interest is negligible. And you say this is not a conspiracy. This is a cultural disconnect, because a lot of us really think that it is a conspiracy. The pharmaceutical companies benefit with the drugs, and the fast food companies, they seem like they're all together in it, like making us sick so that we get the drugs, and everybody seems a part of this craziness.
Yeah, but it's from our perspective, it doesn't seem to be a conspiracy in that sense. The meat companies want to make money, and they will obscure the data the way they want to. All of a sudden, paper comes out on eggs, and nobody checks where the source is and who funded it, and how strong the paper is. And then the next day on Time Magazine, it comes out that eggs are no longer bad for you, or butter. What was it? Butter is no longer
back.
Butter is back. It's not bad. Your twist on what would be popular and what people want to hear is back. And this is this obscuration, industry-driven, you know, this happened with the cigarette industry and still happening for decades, and it's happening again when it comes to the kind of foods we eat and the kind of resources. But I don't think it's a collaborative kind of a thing. It's each industry trying to do whatever to sustain their footprint. But the data has never been in question.
And I also think that it has to do a little bit with our desire for quick fixes.
Yeah.
We're always looking mm-hmm. for a diet du jour, a pill, a vitamin, a very quick fix of what the problem is. And we've been demanding it from the health industry. And so the doctors, in order to have that satisfaction, they essentially, you know, end up pushing pills. On the other hand, I think there's very little faith in the general public's capacity to take care of themselves. From the physician's perspective, a lot of us are trained in medical schools believing that we're not able to change our lifestyle, we're not able to eat healthier, we're not able to exercise. So that's always assumed when the patient contacts the doctor. So, you know, it's just this vicious cycle that we're stuck in, and hopefully we can come out of it.
And now let's look at the physician's lifestyle, life history. 4 years
yes.
of college, and a lot of them, you know, their mom and dad told them to get into, I'm going to get myself in trouble there. So they go 4 years of college, very focused, nothing outside as far as prevention, lifestyle, and they're not the ideal representation of lifestyle by the end of it. Then 4 years of medical school, then 4 years of residency, then 4 years of other stuff. So now already you have 12 years to 16 years gone by, and all you've done is look at disease. And a mm-hmm. cursory little class here and there on prevention, which most of the students didn't attend.
Yeah.
And they don't believe it, even though right now when we actually bill patients, we have to write down that more than 50% of our time was spent giving education. And everybody does it, but they don't give more than 50% education. I know this for a fact. So the disconnect comes because we're not trained on the physician side, and therefore we don't believe what we're not trained in. And then on the other side, you know, the industry pushes what they have to market their product.
I'm laughing because when I visit a physician, I spend most of the time educating them.
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I love that you write that when we nourish our bodies, we strengthen our brains. And if we fail to do that, we fail to nourish our bodies, we fail to nourish our brains. It's all connected. And you were talking about how people believe that the brain is very different from the rest of our bodies.
Yes. So there's somehow there's this perception that, you know, the brain is a completely foreign object that is completely outside the realm of the body, and that whatever we do to it, you know, it's been blocked. It's like a black box. But it's one of the most important, it's the most important organ in the body, because, first of all, you know, it never stops working. It's on 24/7. And it weighs only about 3 pounds, but it consumes more than 25% of the body's energy on a regular basis. So whatever we do to ourselves actually affects the brain first, and then all the other organs second. And it's one of the most resilient, and at the same time, one of the most sensitive of organs. So if we eat well, if we sleep well, if we exercise and do all the other lifestyle important factors, it actually affects our brain. And if the brain is healthy, the rest of the body is going to be healthy as well. And more important than just a physiological change, I think if we're happy and if our emotions are stable, we actually have the motivation to take care of ourselves. And food and exercise and all the other lifestyle factors actually do that.
In the book, we say that if you work on fixing the brain or healing the brain, you don't have to worry about the other organs, because whatever you're doing for the brain, it's the same things you would be doing for the heart, for the liver, for the kidney. But at the same time, you're working on motivational centers, emotional centers, and everything else. So that's why it's so important to focus on this incredible organ. As Aisha said, it is the most sensitive because it's overwhelmed. You know, we talk about sugar at some point. We say that, it's, you know, I'm going to age myself a little. The car, Pinto, Ford Pinto, old car, one of the worst cars. And you, if you put it on junk food, on sugar, on saturated fat, 24 hours a day, you're going to run it down. It's going to break apart. But if you take care of it, it actually gives you the it's forgiving. It's incredibly forgiving. So that's why we're actually moving towards a brain-centered health system, basically.
On this program, it's all about food, which I've been doing for about 9 years. I've talked to lots of experts, and I see the people that are praising your book, Dr. Joel Fuhrman and T. Colin Campbell and David Katz, Dr. David Katz. We've all talked about the benefits of a whole plant-based diet and how it can prevent and reverse heart disease, prevent and reverse diabetes, reduce dramatically your risk of cancer and all kinds of other chronic diseases. But I've never seen this information applied to Alzheimer's and dementia. So many of us believe that we hit 85. If we are lucky to even get to 85, it's just natural to lose our minds.
Right. No, I think the data is fraught now. And I had the privilege of working with some of my mentors at Columbia University, where we studied large populations and how dietary patterns affected them. And it was quite clear that a diet that is primarily plant-based, a whole food plant-based diet, among a population of about 144,000, showed results, you know, in reduction of Alzheimer's disease and stroke and other diseases of the brain. So we actually have experience of working with it directly, and then there's so much data from so many years, you know, coming from studies like the Nurses' Health Study and the Health Professional Study and scientists in Harvard and here in Loma Linda. Loma Linda was actually one of the first places where they studied the consumption of meat and how it affected brain, and they found out that the chances of having cognitive impairment was very high among people who ate meat compared to those who ate essentially a plant-based diet.
This is very exciting. So people who have what they believe is a genetic disposition to Alzheimer's, they may actually have things that they can do to reduce that risk significantly.
By all means, absolutely. We believe that, you know, there are certain genotypes that if somebody has it, they're bound to have Alzheimer's disease no matter what, at an early age. But those are less than 5% of the population. And for the rest of us, for the rest of the 95% of the population, we can actually prevent the disease and push it by 15 to 20 years. And that's the message that we actually give in the book. I think the genetic variations or the genetic predispositions of Alzheimer's disease has been exaggerated quite a bit, and it's just not that way. And we now know that food is probably one of the most important environmental risk factors in developing the disease.
So genetics in this, and there are diseases, if you have the gene, you're going to get the disease. Huntington's disease is one of those, and some of the other ones. But for a lot of the chronic disease of aging, genes basically give you a range. So far they've identified more than 20, close to 30 genes associated with Alzheimer's. These genes are not anything in particular that say that they're Alzheimer's. These are genes that have to do with inflammation or body's response to inflammation, body's response, immune response, body's vascular resilience, and what they call garbage disposal, lysosomal, which is getting rid of waste. So basically, those genes tell you, you know, how good your body is in maintaining health and fighting off disease. And that gives you a range, anywhere, you know, 10 to 20 to 30, 40 years. So what you do, though, throughout your life determines if you're going to move that edge, that precipice, closer to your 60s and 70s or way out into the hundreds, you know, about 90s to 100. That's the picture of genes in Alzheimer's. There are, like I said, about 5% of Alzheimer's are presenilin-1, presenilin-2, and APOE. Those can be affected by genes. In fact, okay. we looked at the population, Down syndrome population, who have a high risk of Alzheimer's. And even in that population, lifestyle had significant effect on developing Alzheimer's. So it's time to, yes, we look at genetics. We look at how genetics affect a person. The genetics actually in the next 10 years will become more important as far as what type and what areas and what manifestation and what are your risks and what you should do in your life because you have this risk. You know, you have a vascular risk, so you should do this and you have this. So in that sense, genetics has been pushed back as secondary and lifestyle is the thing that affects everything else.
You have a number of testimonials in the book, stories about people who came seeking assistance with their cognitive decline. Can you share the most dramatic recovery you've ever seen?
Yeah, there are many. Well, one thing we want to say is there are others that have written books that, about reversing Alzheimer's. We've never made that claim. And I think science says that it's irresponsible to say that. And the data that the people that have presented have been questioned by everybody. But even people who have Alzheimer's can be affected significantly as far as lifestyle by slowing down the disease quite a bit. And also, more importantly, affecting the quality of life and awareness and alertness and all that. And we've spoken about that. The population that we've affected significantly are those that are right at the edge or have pre-Alzheimer's symptomology, pre-dementia symptomology. And there isn't one, but dozens of cases of we have a lady that came in who had significant cognitive decline to the point that it was, although she could still do everything, but it was affecting her driving to some extent and it was affecting her ability to do her finances. Mm-hmm. Yet when we instituted the lifestyle change, which took some time, this is what we tell people. You have to be patient, and you have to build around your strengths, and that's actually another part of the book, and stepwise. It's not an all-or-none phenomenon, so don't worry, slowly. And when we did this with this lady, she actually came back and saying that she was better than ever before. I don't know if I believe that, but we definitely saw complete reversal of symptoms.
And we also had objective evidence of, you know, of her blood tests and of her cognitive tests that actually showed so much improvement. I mean, she came in and she was a big mess. She had a lot of inflammatory markers. Her sugar was high. Her cholesterol was just off the roof, and she was her attention scores were just horrible. It was, you know, less than the 20th percentile. And she was a very, very high functioning woman. She had her own business. She had a law degree. She was taking care of so many other, you know, corporations. So this is somebody who worked quite a bit, and she always complained of a brain fog. And it was amazing to see her get better with all the lifestyle measures.
And with every step that she was improving, that was actually a motivational factor. One of my definitions for motivation is, you know, it's repeated successes. Stepwise successes, and that builds the motivation. So we've had many successes like that, and especially when we built the program around the person's own capacities and strengths, that was significant.
I love this book for so many reasons, and one of the reasons is it's your voices are compassionate, easy to understand, you speak to us in ways we can understand complicated concepts. But I loved most your stories about how you transitioned and how you admit that there were challenges, that you had to learn to like dark chocolate instead of sweet milky chocolate, or, you know, the little things that we love that are important to us for many reasons, how they connect to different things in our life. And we have to work to make change. And I really appreciated that.
Thank you. Thank you. No, I appreciate that comment because, to be honest with you, I think that's at the core of everything. Learning and knowing what the other person goes through to make changes in lifestyle, that empathy part. And, you know, we pride ourselves in our education and the research opportunities that we've had. But, you know, it comes down to sitting in front of somebody who's devastated day in and day out. Devastated because they can't remember. You see the sadness and the tears in the family's eyes. You see how this amazing, incredible person who was free, who was strong, who was living the life, is now beholden to somebody to take him to the restroom. And that's painful. So, you know, instead of just showering them with medication, we realized that there are other ways to actually help them. One of the reasons I actually went to cooking school when I was a fellow at New York in Columbia University was just that. I realized that if I talk about hypertension and hyperglycemia and, you know, high cholesterol to my patients, most of it just goes through and they really don't understand what's going on. But if I take about 10 to 15 minutes of my time and show them how to make a bean lentil chili, because it's actually good for them, it has plant proteins, it has fiber, it's low in saturated fats, and if they could replace one of their meals with that and then make a chickpea sandwich for a snack and get rid of that, you know, BLT sandwich that they've been eating for the last 10 years, that's progress. That's moving it one
that's
step
healthcare.
Forward towards
that's
betterment.
Healthcare.
Yeah, exactly. That's
Thank
healthcare.
Thank you. Absolutely. Everything in this book, not just the data, which is so necessary, but how to do it. And everybody who listens to this show, or maybe there are some new folks that are listening, what we talk about is healthcare is delicious. It's not deprivation. And
exactly.
When you take the time and energy and learn these new things, you'll love it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, you are a couple and you have children. How
Yes.
old are your children?
Our children are 12 and 10. Alex is 12 and Sophia is 10.
And you've brought them along with this healthy lifestyle, of course.
Absolutely. They've been raised in a healthy environment.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm just wondering if you're sitting at the table and the two of you are chatting about your work, and are the kids like rolling their eyes and saying, "Oh, not amyloid plaque again," or
no,
or are
no,
they part of the
They have a website called thesciencekids.com, so they're very much into science and the brain and programming. For some reason, I don't know where they got that one from, but programming, and they do all these kind of videos on health and the science of health on their website. Trying to teach kids about healthy living. So they're very much into the conversation. And ironically, they actually bring up and question and challenge, and that's actually something that's very open in our family, challenge every idea. So we come up with an idea, and then their job is to challenge us. And we have open conversations about it, and we've talked about food, we've talked about, the challenges we face, the environment, animal activism and all that stuff. But most importantly, they're open to ask their own questions and challenges anytime.
I may have to have your children on my show some other time. They'd probably be great guests.
They'd be happy.
They would be happy to.
Fantastic. One of my favorite lines in the book is, "Your rescue is in your stories, in what made you who you are."
Yeah, we've written about this concept of islands of consciousness. Who are we? Where does that reside? I mean, that's where your recovery of the brain takes place. I don't know if you remember the story of Miss Collins. Of course, that's not a real name, but for privacy's sake, who had dementia and had was sick. And one day she was in the hospital for a month, and I was rounding with all these residents, and they asked me, they told me this is Ms. Collins, and she had this and this and this, and she has not spoken for 2 months, and she just looked straight into the room. And I said, so tell me about her. And they said, oh, the sodium is this, the potassium is this. I said, no, tell me about her. And they kept giving me medical jargon. I said, I've looked at the medical jargon. I tell me about her. And they went to the charts, and they came back and said, she was a child of this many, she has this many children. And by the way, yeah, she was a piano teacher for 60 years. I said, ah, okay. So I got in front of her, and I said, Miss Collins. And the residents were getting a little antsy. So she doesn't speak. She hasn't spoken in months and since she's been in the hospital. I said, Miss Collins, who's a better composer, Beethoven or Mozart? Didn't register. She looked right through me. I said, Miss Collins, who was a better composer, Beethoven or Mozart? Then you saw this flicker of connection, and she, in soft voice, she said, what a stupid question. Well, it was a stupid question. I knew that. I mean, if anybody, you don't ask Bach, Beethoven, Mozart. Well, you like them, but you know, but the point being that was her island, her central island. We needed to connect to that. So from then on, we brought the music. We had people talk to her about music, and slowly she got better and better. Never back to baseline because she had underlying Alzheimer's, but she started talking a little bit. That's true to all of us. We have our stories. Our stories give us resilience. Our stories give us connectivity. Our stories give us a story of how to be healthy. Where is the opportunity to be healthy? And where is the challenge of the thing that keeps failing us over and over again? So our stories are, this book is a little different, that actually kind of goes into that, is figuring out the story and where your story gives you the opportunity to build better health and better brain.
There's another book that just came out. I haven't read it, a couple of weeks ago, The End of Alzheimer's by Dr. Bredesen. And I've heard a little bit about his work. Is this, I'm assuming you're familiar with it, is this something that's complementary to what you've been doing, or are there nuances?
No, it isn't actually complementary. It's a little, to us, it's a little, it says it's definitely not plant-based. And in fact, bone broth is a component of.
Oh, please.
Yeah, any that word actually would be problematic in any healthcare environment. The other thing is, it's very gimmicky that if you mix this with this and so on and so forth. So to us, it's not complementary. And I think the people that support it, as you know, are people who are trying to catch the public interest and find things like fat is good for you. And and the irony is, he's actually a good scientist, but when you write completely contrary to science and say that this is what I believe in the science, that kind of throws you off.
Yeah, I we haven't read the book yet, but from his supporters, it seems like the people who actually promote a ketogenic diet and a paleo diet are the main people who support this concept. And, as far as that ketogenic and paleo diet is concerned, a diet that's very high in animal protein and animal fat, we know for a fact that there's no data that supports that at all.
Zero.
It's been almost 30 or 40 years with all the large databases, observational studies, and epidemiological studies. Flawed as they may be, of course, the data is consistently pointing towards a diet low in saturated fats, a diet that is high in plant foods, and it's whole and not processed, is good for the brain. So the rest is, the rest doesn't really make any sense. So, in that regard, it's a completely different book that talks about a completely different approach not really supported by the data so far.
Okay, that was the impression that I got just from reading a few of the testimonials, but I'm glad to hear it from you both. Okay, so I just want to summarize that this book is everything. It tells you what the problem is in some comprehensive scientific terms. We learn what we need to do. It's all in this book. Meal plans, delicious recipes, all kinds of discussions on meditation and exercise, everything that you need to reduce the risk of probably one of the most scariest things that could happen to anyone.
And most importantly, or as important, the fact that because we saw this in the communities, the disparity between the healthiest community, which is the Loma Linda Seventh-day Adventist community, where dementia was almost non-existent or very low prevalence, and the outside community, San Bernardino, which was devastated, and the only difference was lifestyle. All the profits of the book are going back to the communities and educating the communities and creating resources. So this book is not for anything except the communities and furthering the knowledge, the true facts, as opposed to all facts out there.
I want everyone to read this book. I will do my part. Thank you for writing it.
Thank you, Karen.
And, best of luck with your release next week. And thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food. Ayesha and Dean Sherazai, thank you so much.
Thank you for promoting the latest information on health. We're big fans. Thank you for having us on your show.
Thank you so much.
Okay, be well. Okay, everybody, let's take a quick break, and I'll be right back. Everybody, I'm Karen Hartglass. This is part two of today's show. It's all about food. Thank you so much for joining me. I hope you will share this program because what we just spoke about with Drs. Dean and Ayesha Sherazai is so important. Did you know that you could practically eliminate the risk of Alzheimer's and dementia? Did you know that? By 90%, this is groundbreaking. And The solution is what we've been talking about for 9 years on this program. A whole minimally processed plant, delicious diet. We've talked about how it helps heart disease, how it helps diabetes, how it helps cancer, multiple sclerosis, autoimmune diseases, and now our brains. This is so exciting, and I'm thrilled to be able to talk to the authors. I just wanted to add a few more things about the book. So there's a number of myths that they talk about in the book. One of them is about coconut oil. And guess what, everybody? Coconut oil is not healthy for the brain. Coconut oil is a saturated fat, and it increases LDL, bad cholesterol. And that's related to vascular health. The best kinds of fats, we need fats. The best kind, what are they, everybody? Whole, minimally processed fats, mono and polyunsaturated fats from nuts, seeds, avocado, olives, plants, which have been scientifically proven to protect against cognitive decline in numerous studies. And that's what they say here in this book. I love coconut oil on my skin. I also like it on my hair. I'll admit I occasionally use some coconut milk or coconut oil in a treat. And something we didn't talk about in the last half hour was moderation. And they talk about moderation in the book. And it's a very intelligent thing because some people say, oh, moderation. But what does moderation mean to you? They gave an example that, you know, if you're eating pizza 5 times a week and then you eat it like 2 or 3 times, is that moderation? So foods that are not promoting good health, you can have them occasionally, just not all the time, if indeed you don't want to lose your mind. And who does? I don't. Okay, I have had an incredible incredible week. And I'm going to share some stories with you because they're related to food and health, of course. So I'm fortunate to have my parents. My mom's 84, my dad's 89. I've talked about them from time to time on this program. And my dad's having a few challenges these days, and I was taking him around to doctors, various doctors' appointments, and I just happened to decide I would visit them on, what day is it already? Thursday. It's been such a whirlwind. I thought I would help them do some shopping and fix some things in their home and just spend some nice, quiet time. Well, we got a call from one of his doctors that he was anemic and needed to go to the emergency room. So we spent this holiday weekend in the hospital. And like I said in the first part of this show, I was reading this book, The Alzheimer's Solution. And it was so ironic to be in this place where there's only sick care. And I'm reading The Alzheimer's Solution, talking about all of the evidence and research about a healthy lifestyle that includes a whole minimally processed plant-based diet, exercise, meditation, and seeing how it applies to brain health, but it also applies to the heart and our entire well-being. So I had conversations. One doctor, the doctor that was presiding over my dad on Monday, yesterday. she noticed I had this book on the chair. And she said, "Why are you reading that?" And I explained I had this radio show. And I said, "Do you know that 90% of Alzheimer's disease can be reduced? The risk can be reduced by 90% with a healthy diet." And I mentioned that this community of Seventh-day Adventists who are vegetarian, there's a lot of data with them and showing how they have extended longevity, quality of life, and less cognitive decline. And she lit up and said, "Oh, that's wonderful. I'm a vegetarian." And then I added that it's even better if you eliminate dairy products. And then she said, "But we need milk for protein." And I just took a deep breath and smiled. We need milk for protein. Where do people learn this? Not medical school. It's a cultural thing, right? And I told her, "No, we don't need milk. We can get protein from beans and grains." And then she said, "Oh, no, 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 no. Greens, you'd have to eat a lot of greens." And then I said, "Yes, you have to eat a lot of greens. And that's what's so wonderful about it. You get all of this fiber, you feel full." I was looking at her and thinking that she could actually lose a few pounds, and eating greens would be beneficial because it would help her do that. But there's so much that our doctors, well-meaning doctors who want to help, who want to make a difference, just don't know, because the system is broken. And then I spoke to one of the guys who was preparing my dad's room. He was going to move from the ER to a room, and he was with the Environmental Services Group, and he complimented me on my shoes, and I told him, "Thank you. You know what's great about these shoes? They're not made of leather. They're vegan. They're cruelty-free." And he said, "I've been trying to go vegan, and it's kind of hard. It's tricky, you know, but I'm working on it." And I showed him this book, The Alzheimer's Solution, and gave him my Responsible Eating and Living card and said, "Email me anytime. I can help." And so I was trying to make the most of a difficult situation and seeing so many things that were just wrong. And how many times did I want to just stand up and scream and shake them and say, no, this isn't how to heal. No, you don't understand. I have to share, of course, the food that was served. So my dad got a cheeseburger, a beef burger with cheese. It said it had a whole wheat bun. Like, that was a good thing. It looked like a fluffy piece of bread. There was always skim milk served on the tray, and a dessert with like cake and whipped cream. Then he had a roasted chicken at night. It had vegetables. I give them credit. It had a small piece of corn and some green beans. But the main thing on the plate was the animal. And they're serving this to people who have heart disease, people who have cancers. I saw them there, people who had diabetes. And there's this disconnect. Or, now, the doctor's share's eye told me there isn't a conspiracy, but I'm thinking, feed them these foods and your customers will keep coming back. They'll keep coming back to the hospital. It's very, very frustrating. What are we going to do, folks? How are we going to turn this around so that we can help more people? Do you have any ideas? I mean, I'm doing this. I'm talking to you. I'm giving you information. I hope you're sharing it with other people. This world could be a so much better place. And the thing that I think would really be one of the greatest things that would come out of everybody improving their lifestyle, eating better, reducing risk of disease, then our medical community could focus their time and research on the really mysterious diseases that plague us today, rather than focusing on research money and time on heart disease and diabetes and cancer and Alzheimer's. We know what the cause is. We know how to prevent these diseases with a whole minimally processed plant diet and healthy lifestyle, exercise, meditation. We could take all that time and money and put it to the real mysteries. Wouldn't that be nice? I think so. All right. So, continuing on about this week, I had to eat and I had to sleep. And it was really challenging. For those of you who are caregivers, you must know what I'm talking about, how challenging it is. But there were some moments that were real highlights. So my mom and I had a moment to get away from the hospital, and we happened upon a Japanese restaurant. Now, this was in Plainview, New York, on Long Island, if any of you are around there. We went to a little Japanese place called Hamasushi, and I ordered the vegetable sushi. And this was a stunning, fabulous delight. It was just a moment where I could nourish myself and re-energize. And the most exciting part was most sushi, and sushi means rice. Most sushi is made with white rice. And some of the newer sushi places are getting hip. They know people want to eat whole grains. They'll offer their sushi with brown rice. This place not only had brown rice, they had black rice. And black rice is like amazing. So I had this fantastic plate with black rice. I had an opportunity to visit Plantwise, another place on Long Island. And I've been trying to get there for about, well, since they opened. Actually, they were called Plant Strong when they opened. Now they're called Plant Wise. I have a feeling it's because Rip Esselstyn has trademarked Plant Strong. I could be wrong, but that's my theory. And they had to change it to Plant Wise. I brought my parents there, and it was very challenging because they really couldn't relate to the menu. And I was trying to translate what was available and what I thought would be pleasant for their palates. And I realized at that moment that that's actually part of the challenge of helping people transition. A lot of people are, they don't want to change. They like things that are familiar. The authors of the Alzheimer's Solution, they talk about it in the book that when they're helping people transition, they try and make it simple, make simple substitutions. And at this restaurant, there were bowls where they had raw spinach, brown rice or quinoa, and then some sort of main attraction like garbanzo beans in a spicy sauce or something else. And a lot of these herbs and spices my parents aren't familiar with and don't like. And I imagine that's true of a lot of people that are trying new foods, and they'll go to one of these healthy restaurants really with great intention and try something, and the tongue doesn't know what to do with all of those flavors. It sometimes takes time to recalibrate or to introduce new flavors so that the tongue can understand them and recognize them and then decide whether it likes it or not. And I have a funny story. I even had a confusing moment with tongue and taste while I was sitting there. I ordered a smoothie that was called Dream Date. I thought if my parents didn't like what I ordered them, they would definitely enjoy the smoothie. It was blended. It was a blended smoothie with bananas, almond butter, and dates. Something sweet, creamy, a little bit of fat. Who wouldn't like it? And I got little cups, and I poured us each some of it so we could sample it. And yes, the Mr. Softy truck is passing by again. Okay, the song is over. Wouldn't you miss hearing the Mr. Softy theme music during this show? I wouldn't. Okay, so I was finishing up my dish, and I saw a little cup behind my plate that I thought was the Dream Date, the smoothie. And I sipped it, and my tongue was so confused. What is this? It's tart. It's salty. It's wrong. And I just didn't know how to comprehend it for a few seconds. Turns out it was tahini dressing that I was supposed to add to the top of my bowl. And I love tahini dressing. But when you're expecting something that doesn't taste like tahini, and it can be very shocking and disappointing. So I could relate to people who are trying new foods and they don't even have an idea of what those foods are supposed to taste like. So when you take that bite, you don't know what to tell your tongue to anticipate. That's one of the challenges in eating new foods. Okay. I found one dish that really had no spices in it. It had a tomato coconut sauce over garbanzo beans and tomatoes, served over brown rice. I thought my dad would like it, and he did. That was good. The wonderful thing about this restaurant is the portions are large. We each took half of ours, and I got to take all of the leftovers home with me, and I made new dishes with all of them. And you could read about them on my blog, What Vegans Eat. Another thing, I'm learning so much in this short time, just being a caregiver. I don't know that I have the solutions, but I always know that if I can make the food for someone, make it healthy, make it delicious, they will eat it. They will like it. They will want it. But so many people don't have the motivation to cook. They don't know what to cook. And they just fall back on old habits. I try to do the best I can right here at Responsible Eating and Living Headquarters through this program and through my blog and recipes to offer solutions. And that's really the most that I can do short of going to your house and cooking for you. But I know that while I was with my parents, my mom used to cook a lot. And she just doesn't anymore. They're both getting more fatigued, and it's challenging for them. So when I was cooking, you know, my dad came in and said, you know, something smells good. And I could feed them healthy food while I was there. Something so simple as just steaming yellow potatoes, carrots, and onions. Anybody can do that. And you serve that with a salad, and you have a nice meal. It's not complicated. Right. I wanted to go back a little bit again to this book, The Alzheimer's Solution, because there's so much in it that we didn't get to cover. And I just want to highlight some things so that you may want to actually pick up the book and read it and share it with those who need it. And there's that lovely song again. They talked about supplements, and a lot of people spend a lot of money on supplements. And there's a lot of marketing. Sometimes you may get an email or see something on social media advertising the amazing effects of some supplement or some combination of nutraceuticals and supplements that are beneficial for the brain. And what they said in this book is that for most of them, there's no real research to prove the claims that are being made. They did recommend a number of supplements that we recommend often on this program. I mentioned it a few times recently on this program. Omega-3 fatty acids, which you can get in certain foods like flax seeds and hemp seeds, but also, especially as we age, to supplement with an algae-based DHA EPA. I have a little article about Dr. Furman's brand of DHA EPA at responsibleeatingandliving.com. You might want to just read it. It's quick. But the doctor shares, I also recommend that in their book. As we age, it gets more difficult for many people to take what we get from the flax seeds, the hemp seeds, the walnuts, the beneficial omega-3s, and convert them to the things we need, DHA and EPA. And that's why the supplementation is important. Yeah. Okay, we just have a few minutes left. And, oh my goodness, I am running on adrenaline. I know we need to practice what we preach, and I really try to eat well and sleep well, but I have gotten very little sleep for the last few days. And sleep is also a key solution in the package of Alzheimer's Solution. And they actually give a list of recommendations on how to ensure better sleep in the book. Mm-hmm. Yep. They also talk about... I was at another doctor's office today, and I was mentioning this book. And then the physician's assistant, who was doing a number of tests on my dad and filling out forms, she heard what I said, and then she said, "Are you a vegan?" And I said, "Yes, I'm a vegan." And then she said, "I could never be vegan." And it's funny. No, number one, this book doesn't tell you that you have to be vegan. And I can't tell you to be vegan. I would like the world to be vegan. That's my personal thing, because I don't believe in killing animals, but I can't tell you to be vegan. And I can't tell you that we even know for sure that eating a 100% plant-based diet is the healthiest. We don't know that. What we do know is eating a diet that is primarily plant, mostly plant, whole foods, no processed foods. That is what we thrive on. And so I shared that with this woman today in the doctor's office. But it just amuses me because I know a lot of vegans who have told me at some point that they could never be vegan. And if you're thinking I could never be vegan, okay, that's fine. But if you're curious, I'm happy to help you. And you're free to reach me at info@realmeals.org. I love to get questions where people ask, how can I do this when it comes to food? And if we could come up with a solution, that would make me happy and make you happy. So you're free to do that. Oh, one more thing before we end. I think it's really important. They talked about it in the book, and I'm talking about it now. Having conversations with people, strangers, all the time, reaching out just about anything at all. It doesn't even have to be about health, but we need to connect with each other. We're all on our phones. We're all on our screens. And community, having community is healthy. I was in another doctor's office this week, and we were waiting for my dad to be called. My mom was a little anxious, and she was cold because the air conditioning was so high, was so cold. I had just finished interviewing one of the senior researchers for the book Project Drawdown, and we'll be airing that in a few weeks. It was really an exciting interview, and I can't wait to share it. But one of the things we learned in Project Drawdown, which has to do with climate change, is the top 80 solutions to turn around global warming. The number one solution is refrigeration management. So we're sitting there freezing, and I said, do you know what the number one solution is for turning around global warming? It's refrigeration management. And there was a woman who was sitting there, and she got engaged in the conversation. And then I talked about some of the other solutions, and one of them was plant-based diets. And we started a conversation. And I gave her my card, and we're continuing that conversation. And I hope that the information that I share with her will be helpful. Talk to people in supermarkets, in medical facilities, anywhere you can. You know, we're all living on this planet together. We all share this planet Earth. We all want the same things. A healthy life, good food, love, friends, family, right? Thank you so much for joining me today. I think it was really a wonderful program. I'm so glad to have presented the Alzheimer's solution to you today. I'm Karen Hartglass. Have a very delicious week.